Hello, this is Matt Bullitt from BullittsZest.com. For this BullittsZest.com political podcast, we did it in honor of the United Nations International Day in support of victims of torture. June 26th, that's the day the UN honors torture victims, torture survivors. For this special podcast, we tackled the hard topic of torture. Torture is often ignored and oversimplified in the mainstream media. You know, it's hard to talk about torture and sell ads. It's hard to talk about torture without diminishing the topic to some sort of weird, mythologized version of torture that we often see in mainstream media. It's just one of those topics that's really, really difficult to talk about, but we do the hard thing here at Bowler's Desk. So we're going to talk about it, and we're going to honor the over 11,000 victims of torture that live in San Diego. Joining me was Arturo Jimenez-Bacardi. He's a PhD candidate, University of California at Irvine, UC Irvine. He's doing his dissertation on U.S. torture and targeted killing programs since World War II. That makes Arturo an expert in political torture. And Suzanne Bacon, the Community Relations Manager for Survivors of Torture International. This is a San Diego-based group that helps survivors of torture that come to San Diego, that come here as immigrants, that show up at our borders or our airports. She helps them heal. Their website is www.notorture.org. That's www.notorture.org. You should go there, give some money. They offer tours twice a month of their group, and they help explain to people what it's like to be a torture survivor in the United States. They help thousands of people every year. So it's definitely a good group, definitely worth listening to. Did have a minor audio issue, but it got fixed. So, you know, because Bowler's Desk political podcast listeners are not pedantically obsessed with minor issues, and, you know, we're about the content, it's definitely important for us to put this out. Remember, June 26th, International Day in support of the victims of torture from the United Nations. So here you go. Political podcast recorded at the Survivors of Torture International offices. Notorture.org. Bowler's Desk. Political podcast.
Yeah, so I look at the evolution and I compare different targeted killings and torture programs that the U.S. has created during wartime since World War II. And so I've found, depending on how you count them, 12 different programs on targeted killings. So mm-hmm. going back to the assassination attempts against Fidel Castro, Patrice Lumumba from the Congo, Castro being from Cuba, and Rafael Trujillo from the Dominican Republic, and all the way in Gaddafi, they tried to kill him during the Reagan administration and so on, and then four torture programs, or enhanced interrogation technique programs, whatever you want to use, one during World War II, a very isolated case, one during the Korean War for double agents, and then one during the Vietnam War with Operation Phoenix, and then the Bush administration's, you know, very recent enhanced interrogation technique program. And so I look at the evolution of these and how the role that international law, threat perception, technological innovation has played in how these different programs have evolved and are structured domestically.
Okay. And then, Suzanne, you're here with Survivors of Torture International. It's a San Diego organization. Tell me about Survivors of Torture International. So.
Sure. Well, we're a nonprofit organization, and we are here to provide healing services for people who've survived politically motivated torture in their home countries. Many of them are coming here either as they're seeking asylum or because they've been persecuted in their home countries and tortured, or they might be refugees who've also suffered from torture. And so we do mental health, access to medical services, and social services, helping them to rebuild their lives here in San Diego.
So you put sort of a personalized face on more of the academic things that Arturo's talking about.
So I think first it's kind of important to kind of define sort of what torture is, right? I mean, people think of torture as, you know, like when they go to the exhibit at the Museum of Man, they kind of think of it in these kind of romantic terms. But to define what it is sort of legally within the United States and then on the outside the United States, what does that mean?
Well, I guess outside of the United States, torture has been mainly defined through international treaties. And this goes, and they depend too. So first they started with treaties governing warfare. So like the Geneva Conventions, like the Hague Conventions. The Hague Conventions, the definition of torture was very limited, very broad. And then the Geneva Conventions did a much better job at defining them. And then you have the Human Rights Treaty, the International Covenant, or the International Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel and Inhuman Treatment. And so that has a quite specific definition of torture, and usually that's the one that international courts, international tribunals, and also domestic courts, and a lot of constitutions have now adapted that same language. In terms of the U.S., there's also different definitions of torture, so you can have certain definitions of torture inside the U.S. legal system. So police in the U.S., you know, based on courts, decisions, and so on and so forth, have had different definitions of what torture is in the U.S. Then you have the military definition of torture, and that has also changed over time. So in the American Civil War, there was quite a bit use of torture from both sides. Interestingly, U.S. war against the Philippines, so right after the Spanish-American War, that was the first time, say, that the United States started doing court-martials against waterboarding. So all the way back in 1898, the U.S. military defined waterboarding, that specific procedure in their military court system, as being torture. And the Bush administration tried to change that basically 100-year-old precedent. But in the military, it's different than in the U.S. legal system. I mean, there you have the Uniform Code of Military Justice and different types of treaties that define what kind of interrogations are allowed and which aren't. And then you have the CIA, which uses different standards also than the military. So, and this
so give me like the sort of the national standard, like within the United States, how would it be defined?
Well, it goes everything from cruel and inhuman treatment to the use of severe pain and possibly also psychological pain and damage. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yeah, also the Torture Victims Relief Act defines it, as you're saying, with it can be severe physical or mental pain or suffering that isn't part of a legal action. Type of punishment.
Because there does seem to be kind of a certain amount of subjectivity to this, at least within. I mean, you get different interpretations in California than you will in Arizona, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's... you would think something as severe as this, or something that most people would say, I'm opposed to torture, that it wouldn't be as subjective in a way, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, severe mental anguish, I guess if you're the person suffering it, it can be, I don't know if it's that subjective. I think we've started, you could speak certainly more to that, but the U.S. has perhaps made it more subjective. But when we talk about it in everyday terms, mm-hmm. helping people understand that it's not usually happening, that it's not usually an enemy combatant, we're trying to get information from them in the world, it's usually that a government is trying to keep control over its population, and so they're using torture to try to control people, instill fear in the population. Or it could be that the government is unwilling or unable to protect a certain group of people that are being targeted. And it's happening for our organization, it's government-sponsored, state-sanctioned torture.
So this is a government trying to oppress a group of people through torture.
Yeah.
So within, like, people make the argument that, you know, criminal defense lawyers will make the argument that solitary confinement is a kind of torture, you know.
So in Britain, absolutely. We've already had some precedent there that solitary confinement is a form of torture. And there's a lot of psychologists now in the United States that are defining solitary confinement as a form of torture. But, you know, it does go into this idea, the subjectivity of what is torture, and certainly different methods over the years have changed. Just like with the death penalty, I mean, what is cruel and unusual has also changed over the years as well. And I think, to some extent, unfortunately, at least in the United States, when I see polling data, when it starts getting quite specific, you would sometimes, I'm surprised at some of the poll numbers. So when it comes to things like electric shocks, you do get a strong majority of Americans that consider that to be torture. But when it comes to, and waterboarding, for example, then you get a smaller number, but still a majority that consider it torture. But when you get to other things like walling somebody, which the U.S. used a lot during the war on terrorism, or slapping, when you start getting to sensory deprivation, like the changing of temperatures and things like that, you start getting 51, 52, sometimes even in the higher 50s percent of support.
That just, you know, for, you hear these things, and then you think that's horrible. You know what I mean? That it's you're saying 51% of people would support
using that
things.
Type of technique. Yeah.
Has there been a shift post 9/11?
Well, yes. So the part of the problem is that a lot of the polls prior to 9/11, first of all, they were very sparse. So there was like one in the 1950s and so on and so forth. And second, they weren't as specific. The post 9/11 polls are a lot more specific because you have certain techniques that you can ask them about. You can ask them specifically about waterboarding, whereas in the past, you don't have that. You know, in 1960, they didn't ask them what they thought about waterboarding. So
it's okay.
So in terms of the long-term, in terms of the long-term trends of public opinion towards specific techniques like that, we just don't know. Because in the past, they would ask them more broader questions like, you know, torture or something like that. Since 9/11, what has been interesting is that during the Bush administration, actually, support for a lot of these techniques started going down.
But was it during the Bush administration?
Yeah, during, so 2000, so shortly after Abu Ghraib, so that's March or April of 2004, until about 2007, support started going down. It was in the 40s, the people that supported, you know, torture and these techniques. But since the Obama administration has come to power, it's kind of gotten more support, surprisingly. So now some of the polls suggest, you know, the highest one I've seen is like 56% approval rating.
Why would anybody?
I don't know. I mean,
I mean, what's going on sort of in the kind of the national psyche that makes people think this is an okay thing?
I think part of it is our popular media and fear. Mm-hmm. We've had people come up to us, especially our executive director tells a story a lot about people coming up to her who were veterans from World War II saying, this is not the country I fought for. Mm-hmm. This is wrong, what's happening. But when you do the polls, it's often the younger people who are thinking that torture maybe isn't so bad. It's necessary sometimes.
Yeah, and today when they poll the military, they usually, their support of torture is about 10 to 15 points lower than the general population. And obviously, and I would assume that also within the military, if you poll, say, military lawyers, then it's going to be significantly much lower. So the military lawyers were the ones that rebelled against Rumsfeld.
Do you think this is kind of an irony, then, that, you know, people, is it because they're in the military, because they could see this as something they could likely encounter first person?
I think part of it is that reciprocity, but I think a bigger part is the education that you get. So if you're trained in the military, you're trained with the Geneva Conventions. If you're a lawyer, even more so, and you internalize those type of norms. Whereas if you're in the general public, your education of torture are things like the TV show Homeland or 24 and things like that. And
actually,
there's some interesting
just constant.
Yeah, there's an interesting study by Amy Zagart from Stanford University where she's looking at this polling data and they're doing some experiments, and they found that people that watch 24 and Homeland are about 15% more likely to support torture than those that don't. And it's not clear whether it's a select group that already go see those kind of shows or whether the shows themselves are increasing popularity.
Yeah, that's a whole different that's a whole different question there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's can people be programmed into thinking a certain way because of media?
Right.
I mean,
well,
but I feel like there's a certain amount of like naivete and
and almost they're romanticizing. People are romanticizing what torture is, and it's not a romantic thing at all. And how is it? How can you educate people? I mean, that's what you have to do in a lot of ways, right? Because you're helping people who have survived this kind of thing. And so you've got these people who have lived through these horrible experiences and now are fortunate enough in a way to find you to get on with their lives. But how do you communicate that to people outside of their sort of tight circle? It's almost like this fraternity in a way.
Right. Well, first of all, the UN's day, June 26th, also recognizes those who didn't survive the torture because many people don't make it. Mm-hmm. But those who do are very resilient, and they have to be. But what torture does to people, it breaks them down in their body and their mind. So the physical scars and injuries can last a lifetime. And that's often what you see on TV is the physical part of torture. But you don't see the mental effects on people. And one of the most damaging things that it does is it breaks your trust in other people because it's one person doing this to another person. And some of the ways that it shows up for people is they have flashbacks to the torture, nightmares, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, all sorts of things that really you need help to put your life back together, to create a life for yourself. And all of our clients, you know, they had a life back in their home country. They had careers, their family. Many times they're losing their family. They may have been forced to watch their family be tortured or killed right in front of them, and they may also feel guilty that they survived this horrible thing. And we just need to tell people that, in terms of talking about what you're seeing on TV, they never show that. The person suffers some pain, and it's intense during that moment, but after that, it's just kind of forgotten. And that is so far from the reality. I mean, the effects of torture will stay with someone their whole life if they don't receive treatment. Especially, and it can affect future generations, the whole family, the whole society. And if you look at places like Cambodia, I mean, it can affect the whole community and that sense of who can you trust. So yeah, there are a lot of aspects of the effects of torture that people don't think about.
Why don't you think people think about these things?
Well, for one, they don't want to, I think. I mean, oftentimes when we just say the name of our organization, you get to the word torture, and people they're really afraid. They're not sure if they want to know any more about our organization. And I want to say that, you know, I feel it's a very inspiring place to be because we're helping people heal and rebuild their lives. And they have such amazing talents to bring to our communities. And there are over 11,000 torture survivors living right here in San Diego.
Where do they come from?
Well, we've served people from over 80 different countries.
You have a map of the world behind you, and that's where they all come from all over the world?
Yeah, they come from all over the world. Our organization, we happen to see the majority of our clients are coming from countries in Africa and the Middle East, mm-hmm. and there's some geopolitical reasons. You know, mm-hmm. once a group is kind of established in a place, then people tend to...
Yeah, we have a large Somali population, we have a large Chaldean population.
Right.
I think part of it is also denial. And not wanting to. There's the in Chile, for example, under the Pinochet regime, mm-hmm. You know, based on their Truth Commission, they torture about 34,000 people. And
to torture 34,000 people, that's industrial scale torture.
Right.
How does a government do that? I mean, think about the Holocaust, right? And while you can definitely make arguments that governments knew the Holocaust was going on. They knew that was happening. But in general, most Americans weren't aware, I think, because they were kind of out of the loop. They weren't, like today, you know, you didn't have access to that kind of information that you do now.
You don't have Twitter.
You don't have Twitter, seriously. You don't have Twitter to tell you that they're having a revolution in Iran.
Right.
And I could not have covered Iran the way I did without Twitter. I couldn't have covered Turkey without Twitter. I couldn't have covered this. It's amazing. And governments can't turn that off now, which is, you know, really kind of a good thing now. But how does a government in, I would say, kind of post-radio age get away with industrial scale torture like that?
You have secret prisons. That's what they did in Argentina and in places like that. I mean, you can hold sometimes you can hold it inside a military base, and those military bases are quite big, and they have big fences, and then you have a secret prison somewhere in the basement, things like that. Other times you have it in a very secluded area. So in Chile, you had it in Villa Grimaldi in the south, and so very secluded. And I mean, there they did a lot of torture. But I think part of it is also there's a certain some sectors of the population, there's a certain form of acceptance. They bought it into whatever discourse of national security and necessity that you need to take these type of policies. But another part is, I mean, I don't think that everybody, that maybe you have this abstract idea of what torture is. So the example would be the Catholic Church in Chile was supportive of the Pinochet regime. And they didn't want to believe when people told them, look, I got tortured by the regime. They go, you're lying.
Well, they had the same problem in Argentina.
Right. You're just it's propaganda against the regime or something like that. And it wasn't until in some of the cases that happened, one of the psychologists that has been working there for several decades, the story that she told me was what they had to do was they had to take people that had been brutally tortured physically. You can't show the psychological part of it very easily, but you know, the broken bones and things like that. And then you take those people to the church so that they see the scars. And then once they saw the scars, they couldn't deny it anymore. So at that point in the early to mid 80s, then the church started turning on Pinochet because of those excesses. But for a while, either they didn't know about him or they denied it.
He got away with it.
Right.
He totally got away. It wasn't until when did he finally have to?
Well, the first international trial, I think, started in 1998. But, I mean, he basically won that trial. And then he had some domestic trials that on corruption and other things where he died while the trial was still on. But he was at least on house arrest.
Yeah. People make the same kind of... They talk about Franco in the same way.
Right. Well, he got completely away with it.
He died happy and of old
age. And in power.
How do you get away with that now? How does that happen? I mean, it just seems, it's just amazing to people that it happens. It just blows people's minds. Once they realize that, no, they're getting, this is not some isolated, like, police chief someplace in some remote village, this is industrial scale, torture of a specific group of people for specific political reasons, even though these people may not have anything to do with, they're just sort of normal people going about their lives, and they're kind of ambushed into this political.
Two things. I see a positive trend and a negative trend. In the positive trend, here, Latin America is actually a good case of the world, where Argentina, most of the torturers and the military leadership have been tried and have been successfully tried. And recently you have, with Rios Montt in Guatemala, and a lot of these countries, they're getting rid of the immunities that were set as part of the transitional period from dictatorship to democracy. So you do start seeing this wave of domestic trials against former dictatorships that I think have been quite successfully, especially in Latin America, maybe not so much in other parts. But then you have this other new wave, which it's the model of the U.S. and of the Bush administration. And that is that you get lawyers to approve these techniques. And so even if the Bush administration, let's say hypothetically, it's almost impossible to happen, but let's say the United States were to be tried in something like the ICC, and let's say Donald Rumsfeld or Bush were to be tried, just hypothetically speaking, they had approval from the lawyers. So George Bush can stay, he's not a lawyer, and he can sit there and say, look, I had approval from the lawyers. They told me this wasn't torture. In terms of defense, he's got a rock solid case for not getting tried because he did it under the law. You might have to go after the lawyers, but that might, some people would feel that that's a very negative precedent to set. Yeah. But that's another trend. Whereas in the 70s and 80s, when people tortured, there was no legal structure to approve it. They just tortured them. With the Bush model, you're setting this legal structure that can make it extremely difficult for any type of legal accountability. The CIA called this their legal shields.
Yeah.
Because if you get the lawyers to approve it ahead of time, it gives you this, almost this immunity from prosecution because you're acting in good faith because you asked a lawyer to do so. And so that might cause if people adopt that model, it might cause problems for future prosecution.
Have you seen anybody adopting that kind of model?
As far as I know, no, but I haven't done, you know, comparative cases of beyond the U.S.
Not just yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Nothing obvious, nothing in the news.
Nothing that stands out. I don't know if you've...
Because right now it seems like they are these isolated, like in Somalia, which are largely kind of these lawless countries, and that's where a lot of San Diego's torture survivors come from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say, you're saying it's isolated?
Well, no, it's not isolated. It's not like a legal defense. It's just...
doesn't have this clear legal structure to try and...
It's just kind of like whoever's in power is persecuting this group of people.
He was talking about this legal structure, and most countries these days that we're aware of aren't doing things in that way.
Well, some would say Amnesty International cites that there are at least 100 countries in the world systematically practicing torture.
Who's sort of the top? Who's on the top of this 100 list?
Well, Syria.
Syria.
I couldn't name all the countries, but you also need to look at why people are tortured.
Yeah.
And for our clients, some of the common reasons are taking control of the person's land, their possessions. Mm-hmm. Their bodies, such in the case of women, trying to control them, their religion, their ethnicity, their sexuality or their sexual orientation. Lots of things, the political beliefs, their standing in the community, a lot of things that we take for granted here, that there is a legal structure in place to protect you if you are persecuted under something for your religion or something. We have systems in place in the United States to protect that person in general. But in many other countries, it's kind of the government might be unwilling or unable. They look the other way if the police are persecuting people for whatever reason.
Well, in the case of Syria, you look at the Assad regime, and that's kind of what they're known for. You know, I wish Rick Epps could have gotten off of work to come because he spent time in Syria, and we've talked about Syria before, and how if they come, he's talks about Syria as this proxy war between the United States, Europe, Russia, China, and where both sides are funneling guns and weapons, and the people in Syria are stuck in the middle. I had this other friend who spent time in a refugee camp and on the border of Turkey. And for her, she says that the Turkish government persecuting these groups of Syrians was a huge part of the problem, and she became frustrated that she couldn't communicate what was going on to the rest of the world with enough of a loud enough voice.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, your map is full of red dots or red arrows. How do you communicate this message to people in Claremont,
mm-hmm.
you know, who just aren't grasping that this is something that's part of some people's everyday lives?
Right. Well, there's two parts to that. One, I think that people are aware of torture happening in the world. They're just not thinking of putting it under the word torture, because you hear about police brutality in other countries and these things, and that we would consider to be torture. And so they may not realize that they have more exposure to it than they know. We also do what we call the Journey to Healing Tour. I mean, this is on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
We invite people to come to our office, spend an hour with us, learn more about what our clients go through, the ways that we are helping them rebuild their lives, and that there is hope for them to join our community and be a part of our community. And we've had clients, former clients, who've now started their own organizations, working at other social services agencies, having their families grow up here. Many people may not be aware that there are also youth torture survivors who maybe the children were used to get to the parents, or they're secondary survivors where their parents went through something and they're feeling the effects in the family. And we resettle thousands of refugees in San Diego every year. And there have been studies done that show that between 5 to 25% of refugees may also be torture survivors. So there are thousands living here in San Diego, and people may not be aware of that, and so we want to get the word out that this special population is living among us. That's not something people are usually going to share with you right away. And sometimes as Americans, our first reaction is, well, that couldn't have really happened. I don't believe that really happened to you. So people are, they have many reasons why they may not want to share that right away, but we want to be open to that possibility that people might be have been through something like
that.
Is
there kind of this, is there a typical sort of path that a lot of survivors go on when once they come here?
Well, it kind of depends if you're talking about an asylum seeker. Let's take a typical asylum seeker. Okay. So this would be somebody who has made a perilous journey across the world looking for somewhere to call home that can be, that is safe for them. So they'll come to our border and sometimes and ask for permission to stay. And then that starts a legal process in motion where a judge will decide, do we believe this person or not? So they're in their minds sometimes thinking, I made it to the promised land, but it's really only the beginning. So now they need to prove that they were that they're a torture survivor. And usually they've run with nothing but the clothes on their back. So one of the things we do is we work with pro bono physicians who will do medical evaluations, documenting scars, as you were talking about with the church there, documenting scars and injuries that they may have gotten from the torture. And also we have therapists who will document the psychological symptoms. And then they can use that in their case for asylum. That process can take months and years sometimes. And during that time, they're often not allowed to work. They have no income. They have, they're very vulnerable. They are often homeless, no access to anything. So we really need to help provide them with their basic needs as they're...
How do they survive?
Well, many of our clients might spend some time in a shelter. They depend on the kindness of strangers. And we help them build up those basic things you need, just food and shelter, then to get to the level where now they can start to deal with, to process what they've been through and deal with the depression and the flashbacks and the anxiety. So that's when therapy can start. Maybe they'll need to see a psychiatrist. Maybe they'll need some medical services. Maybe if the torture was very severe on their body, they might need medical assistance as well. So, and the healing process takes a different amount of time for different people, but usually once they found a safe place, they made great strides. And one of the things that is really heartwarming for me is how many of our clients will say, you know, I don't have my family anymore, but now survivors is my family. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it I've been here just about 3 years, and the amount of progress that I've seen has really been amazing. So people make great strides when they have the assistance that they need.
So how do you put that personal face on these bigger sort of geopolitical issues that Arturo's talking about?
I think just when we look at each person has a story, and that the effects of torture have, they affect one person, they affect a community, and the effects can go on if they don't get the help that they need.
So how would you communicate these kind of personal effects? I mean, is this even something that kind of enters into the mind of the sort of the bigger kind of international picture?
Yeah, no, I don't go into too much the psychology of the victims. I mean, you do go into, so in terms of strategy, you do always emphasize things about framing the human rights violation is very important in order for that cause to get significant support. But I suppose, I mean, if you're talking about someone in Claremont, sometimes they don't like to hear this, but one of the things that I always like emphasize, because I think it's important, because there's a certain point of personal responsibility, maybe not at the industrial level that we were talking about earlier with Chile, but, if you're talking about the Assad regime in Syria, the United States, with the Bush administration, and we don't know yet, but maybe even the Obama administration, rendered a lot of prisoners of the war on terror to the Assad regime for interrogation and or trial, some kind of mock trial, or perhaps even extra legal execution. The same thing happened in Libya. Human Rights Watch was able to, after Gaddafi was overthrown, we already knew that the United States had rendered prisoners. And by rendering means is the extraordinary rendition program that it wasn't created under the Bush administration. It was created all the way back in the Reagan administration, but it really blew up under the Bush administration.
But that's where we allow certain prisoners or detainees to be interrogated by or tortured by
right.
other
so
countries.
Right, so first the United States
so we'll,
captured someone.
We capture someone and we give them to the Egyptians, for example.
Right, exactly. And so, and you send them into countries where the United States itself, the State Department comes up with these human rights reports every year, so let's say with Egypt. And if you read the Egypt reports, it says that there's endemic torture and all this kind of stuff, and that there's still extrajudicial killings. Mm-hmm. And so the Bush administration, what they did is they took a lot of these individuals where they kidnapped them from all over the world, from Europe, from you know, Africa, and so on.
Well, there's the famous case of the guy in Germany that was kidnapped.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, I mean, the case of Gaddafi was really very enlightening, because now the Human Rights Watch was able to get all these documents from a regime, you know, that normally you can't get these documents. And so you saw the level of cooperation between the United States and the Gaddafi regime when it came to those types of prisoners, and they got brutally tortured. Mm-hmm. And so the United States is playing, in this case, a direct role in terms of some of the victims that get tortured in all of these regimes. And they cooperated with Assad. So, you know, in many levels, they're extreme rivals, and the U.S. is against his regime. But sometimes they have other types of enemies where they're willing to cooperate. And, you know, they don't get these guarantees that those individuals are not going to get tortured, and some of them have disappeared. And so some of the things that I emphasize is that to look at the role that your government is playing in all of this, because that's where you're going to be able to have the most influence. You know, if China tortures, like, you know, it does, the United States or someone in Claremont may not necessarily have a lot of influence over Chinese government policy, but you can at least theoretically have a lot more influence over a program that the United States supports indirectly, and certainly those that it supports directly. So that's usually one of the things that I try to stress.
Is how do you get people to see this, though, for them to want to have this, to have the kind of the inspiration or the desire to have this kind of influence, at least locally or regionally? I mean, the way to do that is to make it personal to them, right?
Right.
I mean, that seems to be the only way people react to anything is when it's something that's on their front doorstep, you know? And that's kind of the problem that you have, because these people are on their front doorstep, but we're still not making it personal in a way.
Right. Well, part of it is, as I said, people don't always want to share that with everyone that they're a torture
survivor. Yeah, I mean, it just seems weird, because I don't need to hear my grandfather's stories from Okinawa for me to value his sacrifice there, you know?
Right.
And I, you know, why is it we need to hear these firsthand accounts? Is it, 'cause that's kind of what you're saying, right? That the survivors don't want to share these firsthand because it's hard.
But
why
also
do we need that?
Right. Sometimes also their family may still be in danger at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so if word gets out where they are, it could cause harm to their family. You know, I think it's, for many people, it's something scary to think about, and they don't see the hope that and the power that you can have to create change, positive change in somebody's life now. Maybe you didn't have anything to do, obviously you didn't have anything to do with what happened to them in the first place, but you can help somebody heal. You can help somebody recover. And One little example that, and for me, as you were talking, it's hard for me not to have the personal face on. It's much harder for me to go to the global level because I'm seeing the personal faces every day.
Right. Yeah.
But sometimes we'll have a client who'll come in, and when they first come here, they're not sure they can trust us either. And that's one of the things we need to do is build up their trust. And we'll have clients sometimes who are so fearful that we have one room, our kitchen, that has two doors, and that's where they feel comfortable going because they don't want to go into a room with only one exit.
Hmm.
And I just think that's a really concrete example of, that's, for me, that's not something I think about when I go into a room. I'm not afraid that this person's not going to let me out. But that's what it does. That's what torture does. It breaks that trust, and you don't know who you can trust. And your dignity, all these things have been just so attacked that it's difficult. It's difficult, but not impossible to recover from. And you just need help. So, why people don't? I mean, I think once people learn about it, they are inspired, and they are, inspired by what torture survivors, the resilience that they demonstrate.
Is there somebody locally that's sort of your biggest kind of, I guess, your biggest, you know, proponent?
Well, we have a lot of community partners, if that's what you mean.
Well, right. I mean, I don't know about. I mean, who's is there like a big sort of star? Is there somebody
like a Nelson Mandela
for the movement?
Oh,
does that make sense?
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that, you know, there are many. There's another group called TASC that is made up of torture survivors who are speaking publicly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really powerful message. There are people like Carlos Mauricio, who has successfully fought cases against his torturer. And there are organizations that will help survivors in that whole judicial process of trying to get legal justice from what happened to them.
So can they do that in the United States?
Yeah, there's an organization called the Center for Justice and Accountability that will help them, especially if there's a torturer living in the United States.
Does that happen?
That happens sometimes, yeah.
So how do they sue them in the civil courts? Is that how you do it?
Yeah, since the 80s, there's this famous case that I can't remember. I want to say it was a Peruvian that got tortured, and it's part of the alien tort law. And so foreigners can have civil cases in the United States where you can torture, where you can win from a foreign government. Yeah, you can sue for human rights violation of a foreign government.
So do your clients here sue their government?
Some of them may. We're really facilitating healing, and so mm-hmm. that's what we're focused on. If that's part of their healing is to get that legal justice, then we would help them find the resources for it. And, you know, you were mentioning the... It's a right. People have a right to rehabilitation. And I'm just going to read this little thing here. But the Article 14 of the Convention Against Torture mm-hmm. states that people have a legal right to fair and adequate compensation, including the means for as full of rehabilitation as possible. Mm-hmm. So it's a right. And unfortunately, the funding isn't always there to make that right possible. And so you do what you can. Each person can do what they can. But... as a community, as a society, we have a right to help people who've been through that.
Earlier we were talking about sort of this over-romantic notion of torture, and you think of
I don't know if I'd like the word romantic.
Well, I'm speaking literarily, okay. not like candlelight dinners with your... I don't mean to give it
term,
but you know, I suppose they're kind of mythologizing torture in a way, and I mean, nationally we do that through cop shows, where we have a suspect in an interrogation room, the cop loses his temper and punches the suspect, tells him where the money is or the drugs are or the kidnapped kid is. You know, and that was a lot of Bush's argument too, essentially was his argument for enhanced interrogation is what they called it. I mean, does it work?
Right, the ticking time bomb scenario.
Yeah. Does it work? Do you get? Will you get any? I mean, because if you know the time bomb is ticking,
I think
it's going to blow up. You would just wouldn't if you just.
Right. I think for the ticking time bomb scenario, most people have made a good argument that it doesn't work. I'm not willing to say overall that torture in itself doesn't work, and I'll explain why in a second. But there's other costs mm-hmm. to it, and so. With the Bush administration, there's huge disagreement. But like the FBI, for the most part, said torture doesn't work. A lot of you know, we've had a lot of people from the CIA, like Rodriguez, who's the head of the clandestine service, who came out with a book completely defending and saying that torture does work. You've had CIA manuals in the 1950s. The CIA carried with QBARC, this manual that you can now download online, and it was they did both. Physical torture, but they focused more on psychological torture. And they found that psychological torture was a lot more effective at working. In terms of does torture work, I think one can actually make a good argument that torture does work. So if we look at Peru, mm-hmm. you know, their dirty war against Sendero Luminoso. Sendero Luminoso was also extremely brutal. And the Peruvian government was... absolutely, I mean, relentless in their assault against him. Now, they were quite successful at pretty much destroying the Shining Path, mm-hmm. at destroying that guerrilla movement. But it came at a heavy cost, which means is that a lot of innocent people are, I mean, thousands of innocent people will get caught in these dragnets and will get killed and tortured. And so if you torture someone, they're going to give you 10 false names, but maybe the 11th might be a real name. And so if you're willing to, you know, because it's not going to be very reliable in information, but at some point they might give you some snippet of good information. So if as a society you're willing to do the Perubian model, which is to, in order to destroy the so-called threat, you also go after, you know, tens of thousands of innocent victims. If you're willing to pay that price as a society, then I think torture and that type of brutality can work, at least in the short run. We don't know if in the long run. And so, I mean, and in the Peruvian case, you know, I think the good thing about it, at least, is that they've had some kind of justice, in the sense that the head of their secret service is now sharing a cell, or is next to the former leader of Sendero Luminoso. So you literally have, you know, the two guys that were fighting each other with the same type of brutality, using, you know, mm-hmm. state-sponsored terrorism and terrorism on the other side, are now in a jail cell, you know, in the bottom of a jail. So that case, one could argue, look, they were very successful at destroying this guerrilla insurgency, but at what cost? And so in that case, torture might have worked, but 90% of the people that got killed and got tortured were completely innocent.
Yeah, I would say...
And it's your clients that make up that 90%.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, right. And torture works to destroy communities, to create fear. Does it work to get correct information? Well, there's a report right now sitting on Senator Feinstein's office that says, no, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing people can do today, if they're listening, is write to Senator Feinstein, ask her to appropriate more funds to the Torture Victims Relief Act, and also to release... Mm-hmm. those documents describing the CIA enhanced interrogation program with as few edits, redactions as possible.
Yeah, I should have emphasized that it does work, but non-coercive interrogation techniques work better, are more efficient. But if you want to use torture, I mean, for some reason, you're...
It's almost like what you're saying then is that non-torture works better.
It works
but
better.
But if you like to torture people...
Exactly. So Stroessner in Paraguay apparently loved to torture people, about 20% of the population, some estimates.
He like got personal...
Yeah, and there's a lot of reports that he was involved in, you know, maybe not the torturing himself, but he was in the room where some people were tortured. He's the most famous Latin mm-hmm. American, you know, he was a dictator for about four decades. And in his case, he actually didn't kill a lot of people, but he loved to torture people, as mm-hmm. in Paraguay. And literally about 20% of the population got tortured in Paraguay. And so, you know, you can make an argument that Stroessner probably loved, you know, he enjoyed torturing. He was at that level of kind of sadistic individual that enjoyed it. And, you know, he was able to crush whatever mini insurgencies you had in Paraguay.
I was just going to say, how do we get our governments to react? You know, you call Feinstein, but it doesn't seem like this is something that's top of their agenda. Why isn't this something that's on top of... I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of other things. You could say, oh, well, the recession is bad. You could say these are... But why can't we put this at that same level? Are we just tired of it? Is this something that we've seen so much of, you know, since Cambodia and the killing fields and Vietnam and all these things? Or are we just in denial of it, not willing to talk about it? I don't.
Well, part of it, I mean, in the U.S., is, I mean, the Feinstein report, they're talking about this fantastic 6,000-page report that the Senate did an investigation, and that they, you know, they refused to release it, to declassify it.
Yeah.
So Feinstein wants to declassify it. So certainly there's petitions out there that I've signed for that report to get declassified, because there's still a lot about the Bush administration's torture program that we don't know about. To some extent, is part of a successful human rights campaign is that you have to shame those individuals that committed torture. I mean, that's an important part of the process. So that, as an example, at least maybe Pinochet didn't get to go to jail, but he was certainly shamed. And his last couple of years, it was a very humiliating example, in case somebody else in Chile decides to go that same route. And so for the United States not to repeat this, I think a big part would be maybe it would be too idealistic to prosecute some of the people that authorized these regimes. But what you can certainly do is you can shame them. Mm-hmm. And in order to shame them, you need to have that information. And right now, I mean, something that you could do is pressure the Senate and the White House to release the torture report, the 6,000-page torture report. That way, there can be another conversation about what the excesses of the war on terror under the Bush administration and shaming the individuals that were involved in it. That way it's not repeated. And that actually worked for a while. So the CIA, during the Church Committee reports in the 1970s, was extremely shamed with the assassination attempts, mm-hmm. with the internal, the eavesdropping of Americans. It actually worked for a while. I mean, the CIA was very scared at doing these kind of crazy things for several decades. And it wasn't really until the Bush administration, and it was the White House people that were pushing for these things to get advanced. And a lot of people in the CIA didn't want to do it. They were the Church Committee generation didn't want to go down that path again. And so, you know, in the U.S. it worked with the Church Committee reports of the 70s. So perhaps if you shame this generation, that could have some kind of long-term effect. I don't know.
All right. Is there anything you want to add that you think we're missing out on? I know it's a heavy one. Normally,
it is a heavy
normally,
one.
You know, we have these kind of, they're more casual, mm-hmm. slightly obnoxious discussions. You can't really be obnoxious about a subject like this. You can't make these jokes. It's too soon, right?
Well, people often do. When I tell them where I work, they'll often, I think that's a defense mechanism, uh-huh, too, right. is to make a joke about it. Or they'll say, well, you know, bad guys deserve to be tortured. And I think that's a common thought. But it's what the thing I would
return
with is... That's that
55% that we were talking about, yeah. right?
Who's now. Determining who the bad guy is? And you can look example after example of, you know, in our own country where the bad guys, years later, you look back and say, how did we let that happen?
Yeah, we still have innocent people in Guantanamo that the U.S. Yeah. government has deemed that, you know, no through investigations, that they're no threat whatsoever. Yeah. And they've been held there now, you know, for almost a decade.
Did you hear that the Slate released, they had the Guantanamo stories, and they read them, and they actually posted them online with their reading. Mm. And it's kind of haunting when you listen to them, because it's this guy's personal story of being in Guantanamo, but at the same time they had to clear it through channels, so there's sections that are redacted. Mm. Mm-hmm. And what they did was, for every line that was redacted, they actually read the word redacted. And there's certain points where he's telling his story, and it's almost like it backfired more on them to redact it, because then your imagination just goes wild.
Right.
He tells these stories, and he says, and then they came and got, and then, you know, redacted, and then, you know, brought him back, you know, with, you know, in pain or with his legs broken or something like this. And then he explained to me that they, and then they just go on for like 5 minutes, and all you hear is this monotone kind of redacted, 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 yeah. redacted. And that's Guantanamo. And that's not Syria.
Right.
That's not us taking people that we've rounded up and sent to Egypt to soften them up before we go in and get our questions. So, I mean, you know, and then to go back to this mythologizing torture and the movie, that famous movie that came out, the CIA.
Zero Dark Thirty.
And that kind of further mythologized torture, mm-hmm. and the people they were torturing, and they kind of seemed, in a way, if you were able to look at it from a bit of a distance, to show these as these people that think some of these guys they caught, not necessarily as cut and dry bad guys.
Right.
You know. I don't know, it just seems weird that we would be aware of this and yet still continue mm-hmm. to support these things.
I think as long as it becomes something that's so far from you, or it's just on TV, or it's hard to imagine that it's, to realize that it's really real and what the effects are on people. That just can destroy people, and to bring them back takes a long time, and there's so much pain and suffering that people have to go through from this. People
But there's this presumption of guilt, and then there's this fear factor that basically gets people to, you know, and it's these other people. It's
right, not affecting exactly, us. Making them the
so
other.
So there's all these different elements that just get 50% of the population to be okay with it. You know, and in the Republican national debates this time around, you didn't even have John McCain to at least have one candidate to be opposed to.
The only guy I think that was...
Right, had military service.
Military
had
service.
Been tortured himself.
And had been tortured.
Yeah. Right, so very different. I mean, but in the last field of candidates in the Republican Party, I mean, it was frankly...
I mean, this has become like the political hot potato. I mean,
right.
Even Obama can't really take a position too strenuously against torture. Because
no, I think on torture he does. I think on that he does. He doesn't on other, on, you know...
Well, it seems like he does publicly, but there's really not a lot that he actually does.
Well, maybe. So he's continued extraordinary renditions. We don't know to what level, but at least he did sign these presidential orders banning all the enhanced interrogation techniques, which remained, which weren't that many by that point. The Bush administration had banned all of them except four, and so at least the CIA and the military and JSOC no longer directly conduct torture themselves, or a U.S. contractor, at least, you know, within a legal framework. Now, you might still have these, you know, there's reports now that, that what you have, say, in Somalia, you might have somebody that gets kidnapped and the CIA still benefits from that information of that individual being tortured. But I still think that that's a level below being directly involved in, you know, setting up this network of torture where it's your own citizens, you know, your own soldiers, your own CIA case officers that are engaging in torture. I don't know if, you know, I do think that that's a step.
That's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. I mean, the other...
It's not as far as you
it's
want
not,
to
Yeah, it's not as I'm, far, but it's not as bad.
I mean, he still hasn't let the what is it, 80 or so out of Guantanamo?
Yeah, something like that. I don't remember the exact. Yeah, there's a number of things that I would have loved Obama to do. That he could do.
He doesn't have a lot of power in certain areas, but he could have
right.
a direct.
Well, one thing that he could do where he certainly has. So maybe closing Guantanamo, there is a good argument that Congress, you know, if they don't want to fund it, then he's got a problem with that. But something that he could do is not allow, you know, have some accountability for the people in the past administration that tortured. And at the beginning, you had. The White House legal counsel, the main White House legal counsel, he very much wanted to have accountability for people of the Bush administration. And what happened to him? He was basically forced to resign within 6 months of the Obama administration. The Justice Department carried out these investigations, and they censured people like John Yoo from the Office of Legal Counsel that approved all these different torture techniques. But they decided explicitly, you know, Obama said, we need to look forward, not backward.
Yeah.
And historically, that's a big mistake. I mean, that's the good model of Latin America, which when it comes to torture and human rights violations, Latin America is not always the greatest place to look at. But something that Latin America is doing well is that it's trying at least to end the impunity, the legal impunity. And they're starting to set up serious accountability mechanisms to where Argentina, to where past torturers and other types of human rights violators are being held accountable. And the Obama administration, this is something that they could do. The Justice Department could go after some people in the Bush administration, but of course politically that would be...
Yeah, you wouldn't, you know, they would.
Right,
yeah.
But that's something that he has the power to do, but he chooses because of politics, and I understand, but that's something that he could do. He can't say, as he does in Guantanamo, oh, it's not up to me because Congress chooses not to fund any type of transfer of a prisoner from Guantanamo.
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, it's up to him. It's up to the Justice Department.
Yeah. But at the same time, he could help. He can help more survivors.
Right, certainly.
Right. Well, with the Torture Victims Relief Act, having more money appropriated to it, there are approximately 30 torture treatment centers across the United States, and all trying to help torture survivors.
How many torture survivors are there in the United States?
The government estimates that there are 500,000.
Wow.
Wow. Do they come from just sort of even, or do they come from even places across the globe, or are they more, is it more specific to places where the United States has been involved?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I think it you know, it ebbs and flows. Each region will have its high points where there'll be more people from a certain area.
I mean, so when they get here, do they just like show up at the border? Is that how they do it, or get
well,
off
like
plane?
I said, for asylum seekers, some of them are coming up through Central America, riding the trains. Some people are taking a plane. They might spend their life savings to try to get here. The refugees, of course, are helped through the. There's a federal program that helps refugees resettle here, where they have limited, about 8 months of benefits and some assistance to get settled here. But many, many challenges that they face, especially, obviously, on top of all of it. You know, you're a torture survivor. You've got the new culture, the new language, the new people, no family, all those things.
So what's your So we can end on a high note.
Sure.
give me your favorite success story.
Okay. I think probably one of my favorite success stories, I'll call him Abdi. It's a young man from a country in Africa, and he had been involved in a peaceful political demonstration, and he was imprisoned. Everybody who was involved in that was imprisoned, and he was for several months, and he was tortured. Well, he had connections with a religious group that was able to get him out. And he made this long journey trying to find a safe place to be. He came to the United States finally to San Diego, and he was in the detention facility that we have at the border.
The one in Otay.
Yeah, where people sometimes are. When
I won an Emmy for that story on that thing. It's the privately funded Corrections Corporation of America detention facility. It's really a prison where they hold undocumented. They've got people that have been there for years, and they have no country to go back to. That's another
right.
Podcast.
But some of our clients are there, and they're wild.
And they're just stuck there until they get.
The rules are often changing, but it can be sometimes whether if they can kind of prove who they are, and many times they don't have any documents. And I don't know all the rules, but they do change from time to time. But there are other organizations that will help. Provide pro bono legal services to them, like Casa Cornelia. And so many times a lawyer will refer, in this case, going back to Abdi, he was referred to us to get those evaluations, the psychological and the medical evaluation to use in his case. And eventually he was released from the detention facility, but he was very depressed. And in his country, mental health was kind of foreign. And so I remember when he told me, you know, I didn't realize that
It's not just frowned upon. It's like it doesn't exist.
It's just sometimes the words aren't even in the vocabulary to talk about depression. Not really part of the culture to recognize that the way it is recognized here. So he was depressed, and he wasn't in doing the things that he liked to do. He wasn't interested in, you know, doing much, leaving the house or anything. So he started seeing a therapist here on a regular basis, and eventually he was granted asylum, and he had permission to work. He started working at one of the fast food restaurants in town. Then he started driving a taxi. And then one day I got a call from him, and he now is working with another agency in San Diego that's helping other newcomers and helping them with that whole process of getting used to living in this community. And that all happened within about 2 years. And the change in his demeanor, just going from being obviously depressed to this happy, cheerful person has so much to give to our community. One of my own personal favorites.
So his process of healing is to help other people.
Yeah, and many of our clients have that as they want to get involved in human rights. They want to have a positive impact and try to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen to other people.
So how do people get involved with your group?
Well, we have our website, www.notorture.org.
There'll be a link.
No torture.
And is there if people want to give, is there like a PayPal?
Yeah, we have a donate button there.
Okay, good.
thank you. And we also, as I mentioned, we do what we call the Journey to Healing Tour. And that is where you can hear many more success stories. You can learn more about the services we provide and actually come here and hear from one of our clients, their experience with working with survivors. And we do those twice a month. And so you can find the schedule also on our website. And that would be just the first step in to learn more about us And we're always looking for volunteer drivers, for people to donate, for people who might be willing to donate their services as a physician or a dentist. We have many therapists that work with us all throughout the county. People who are interested in helping us, we'd love to be in contact with them.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for spending time and talking about such a heavy subject. Hopefully, at some point, we'll be able to talk about something much lighter in the future. I mean, this is great, and that's, I think, the problem is that it's a heavy, heavy topic.
It is.
And you can't say torture and smile. Famously, there was this photojournalist, James Nahue, he did this a book about torture victims. Mm. And one of the problems he was talking about with photojournalism is, like, you can't sell a Rolex with a picture of a starving baby.
Right.